does not.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. I am opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Thursday, February 12th, 2015. So I'm just going to switch up the agenda order a little bit today so that we can hear from Representative Greenlake and Representative Barnhart, who are here to testify on a bill. We're also going to have the public hearing on House Bill 2191 include the information that was going to be part of the informational hearing, because that's really what the bill's related to. So nothing too strange there. So I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on both House Bill 2559 and House Bill 2574. If you could come forward, please. Welcome, very much.
I've never noticed the resemblance before.
Well,
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My colleague suggested age instead of beauty be the lead off. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlake, House District 33. And I'm delighted to be here to talk about these two bills, which are identical and will continue identical as we go along, which includes both energy and the environment. And the story is a rather simple one. One of my constituents, Jerry Weiser, is a constituent of mine who lives in a house that's a part of a homeowners association. He desired, because he thought it was in the public interest and in his interest, to put solar panels on his house, and the homeowners association thought that was a bad idea and denied him permission to do that. Basically, this bill, in a form that needs to come forward, and my colleague will talk a little bit more about this, we think we need an amendment to it, and we'll get that to you, is an attempt to allow people who want to put a solar panel on their own home to do so at their will. And that's basically my story. Now the backstory.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Phil Barnhart. I'm a state representative from House District 11. I ended up with a identical bill to the one that Representative Greenlake had drafted because of the same issue, and I would obviously recommend the committee proceed with his bill as it has an earlier number. The issue, as he described it, I think is the correct one. There are already a number of laws in the books that restrict that prevent the restriction on solar energy systems on residential and commercial structures, but the prohibitions are not on design committees or boards of directors of homeowners associations. Rather, they're on cities, counties, and other other governmental organizations. And so, this actually extends those current rules permitting solar energy systems that are already on the books, but to those non-governmental organizations. As I've looked at this at the bill on page 2, section 3 and 5, it occurs to me that an amendment that makes it absolutely obvious that design committees and boards of directors of these homeowners associations are not allowed to prevent the installation of solar panels, solar energy devices, in a language that's a bit less legalistic and clearer, might be useful, primarily because my experience has been that those organizations often work by custom. They have a set of ideas about what a community ought to look like. They don't have lawyers on their panels. They tend to work informally. Having language that is direct and clear to them that they're not allowed to interfere with a homeowner who wants to install solar panels on the roof of their house, that they can't prevent that, I think would be useful. this language very well may cover that, but I don't know that it does it clearly enough so that a homeowner or a person who's asking to construct a home in a in one of those planned unit developments might not come afoul of somebody reading the law and not understanding that it applies to them. So if the committee would indulge us to attempt to write an amendment that, that makes the makes it clearer to the uninitiated, that would be useful. But I would commend this to your attention. The reality is that distributed power is becoming more and more important. The committee, of course, is working on that in many other areas. It is essential that we not get in the way, that we don't allow planned unit developments, homeowners associations, cities and counties from getting in the way, to get in the way of the installation of properly constructed solar panels installed with the use of electricians approved by the people who are designed to approve these things for safety purposes, none of which this bill would change, and move us away from coal burning and toward electrical generation with renewable energy systems. That's what this is about, and I commend it to your attention.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative Boone.
I'm still a paper person, partially. Are these exactly the same bill?
They it turns out that they were identical.
Okay, that's
and,
what it
and
like.
So moving one of them accomplishes the other.
We both independently asked for a bill.
So how does that follow up? How does that work? Do we run exactly the same bill through twice?
No. We'll bring in an amendment for the bill with the lower number.
Right.
Do what?
We'll bring in an amendment to 2559 and request that you
Here's that you move
bill.
That one.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is a situation where we independently asked for a bill to do the same thing, and the Legislative Council thought it would be easier to just make two bills the same, give him one and me one.
Right.
You know, I learn something new every session.
Well, in 2001, I had a bill that it affected insurance notifications, and it turned out that the then most influential Republican, not in the leadership, had had drafted an identical bill. So this is the second time this has happened.
Wow.
And I'm very pleased to be associated with the Representative Greenlick on a bill like this.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, again, I need to delve into this a little bit further, but so would this preclude any HOAs from establishing criteria that they want to establish simply because they want to live in a, and have dwellings and do stuff that they want to do and that they value? How does this not circumvent their rights to establish a HOA that meets their criteria?
Thank you. That's a really wonderful question. I don't believe it, that the legislature should allow an HOA to prevent people from putting in properly installed solar panels. That's the policy question. Now, a slightly different question where I would agree with you if that's the point of it. They still have architectural requirements. They still have design requirements. I think they can tell you that you know, they don't want them in the front yard. If you're going to put them in, you're going to be on the roof. They have to meet building code requirements. The statute that I have been frantically looking for and can't find, maybe it doesn't exist, but I think it does, restricts counties from doing these things, and it does allow some restrictions based on design and the location of installations. I think that the Homeowners Association would still be allowed to apply those kinds of rules. But simply having a prohibition on the installation of solar panels is something that I believe should be against the policy of the state of Oregon for the reasons I've already listed.
Madam Chair, to be
completely blunt about it.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I think the Homeowners Association have a lot of power now, but that power is bounded by statute. And this would be simply one more piece of things that the statutes would not allow them to prohibit. And it seems to me it's not whether they have unbridled power to do whatever they want. They don't. There are statutory limitations to their authority now, and this would just add one more piece to that.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your comments, but as you were speaking about allowing the Homeowner Association to have this architectural power, but not allowing them to prohibit solar panels, I can imagine the architectural specifications as such that would make it impossible to put solar panels on. So I'm just curious how you would address that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Holvey. That, of course, is always an issue. It's always a possibility. But I think that in other areas where homeowners associations are restricted to design considerations and architectural considerations, when they take a position that actually prevents the protected activity from taking place, the courts have told them that they're not allowed to do that. The reality is, I think, that the design committees in many places are very interested in maintaining a look, maintaining a kind of style in the facility. The object of this bill is not to prevent them from doing that. It's simply to say that style can't include the prohibition of solar panels.
It doesn't look like there are any other questions. Thank you both so much for bringing up these bills. It seems like great minds think alike.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll be back with an amendment for you.
Thank you. All right, so we did switch the order for the agenda today, and so I only have one person signed up, Mark Pengilly. So you can come forward. If there are other folks who would like to testify on this, you are welcome to come up at this time, too. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Pengilly. In 2011, I was the chief proponent of House Bill 3516, which was the statute, I don't have the codification of it, to which Representative Barnhart referred. That was a bill which barred local governments from imposing land use review fees and barring rooftop solar. The design standards were mentioned, and when that bill passed in final form, for example, it barred applications where the solar panels were not in the same plane as the roof plane, or which exceeded the peak height of the building or the roof, the footprint of the building, and no ground-mounted installations were permitted. So I think that it's, as the representatives mentioned, it's the absolute prohibition that's the problem here, and that HOAs can certainly use architectural standards to permit this. But I thought I came up here supporting both bills. Now I've learned I'm just supporting House Bill 2559. But I think it's a good bill, and that members of HOAs should have the same rights as other citizens to put solar on their roofs if they're able to. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you so much. All right. If there's no one else who would like to speak, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bills 2559 and 2547. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2191. Beth, could you go ahead and give us a little information about this bill?
I will. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2191 would establish the Task Force on Air Pollution to conduct a study and develop recommendations on legislation necessary to respond to rules and regulations adopted by the U.S. EPA under Section 111D of the Federal Clean Air Act. There's no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you. And so to start off this public hearing, I'm going to go ahead and call up the people that we have to talk about the Clean Air 111D overview. That is what this task force bill is really related to, an opportunity to have a discussion around this issue, which members of this committee have expressed interest in. So I'm going to go ahead and call up Colin McConaughey from the Department of Environmental Quality, Andy Ginsberg from the Department of Energy, and Jason Eisendorfer from PUC. Welcome.
Get the slides then. Okay. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, thank you for your interest this afternoon in EPA's Clean Power Plan. For the record, my name is Colin McConaughey with the Department of Environmental Quality. EPA's proposed Clean Power Plan is a major initiative at the federal level to curb greenhouse gas emissions. The proposal as it stands would reduce carbon dioxide emissions from existing coal and natural gas power plants by 30% by 2030. Coal and natural gas power plants happen to be the largest concentrated source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. And as we just heard, EPA is issuing this proposal, the Clean Power Plan, under its authority of from Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. Before I get any further describing EPA's proposal, just want to give you a brief overview here of the timeline. EPA issued their proposal last June, and at that point opened a public comment period that they had scheduled to close in the middle of October of last year. They extended the public comment period by about 45 days to December 1st, and that extension, as we understand it, recently caused them to push out when they anticipate the final rule to be published. They had originally said that June 1st was when they were going to issue the final rule. We have since heard that there's no specific date, but to expect the rule later this summer. Once EPA publishes the rule, they have said that states will have a year to complete state implementation plans, which I'll describe in a little more detail later, with an opportunity for a 1 or a 2 year extension to developing those plans if the states need new legislation to enforce the measures in the plan, or if the states are working together to file multi-state plans jointly or to coordinate certain elements of their plan. I'm not going to walk through this slide in detail, but I think it's important to mention before getting into the EPA's proposal that we, our agencies, DEQ, Department of Energy, and PUC, have been working closely with one another as well as with a variety of state stakeholders. And I think those stakeholders are probably the groups that you would imagine given a proposal affecting the electricity sector. Those are the public and the private utilities serving Oregonians, as well as the independent power companies that operate power plants and sell that power on the market, and of course the environmental ratepayer interest groups here in Oregon. And we'll continue to work with these stakeholders, as well as participate in some regional and national forums that have cropped up to assist states as we grapple to understand EPA's proposal on how we can implement it and comply with it. So getting into the Clean Power Plan as proposed, the process that EPA has chosen to and in some ways must abide by is in part prescribed by Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. And that section first directs EPA to develop a national emission guideline based on what is called the best system of emission reductions. And the Clean Air Act defines the best system of emission reductions as composing all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce the targeted pollutant from the facilities in question. So in this case, EPA is directed by Section 111D to develop a national emission guideline composed of all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from existing coal and natural gas power plants. Once EPA has developed that guideline, they then apply that. It's a single uniform national guideline, but when they apply it to states in the next step, that results in state-specific emission targets because of the very different factors on the ground, the very different electricity sectors that exist, or the infrastructure and the demand characteristics that exist within each state. So again, want to emphasize there's a single emission guideline that EPA has developed here, but it is when they apply it state by state, it results in very distinct state-specific emission rate targets that each state is given. Once states are given those emission reduction targets, we're then directed as states to develop plans for how we want to achieve those targets. And Section 111D and EPA in this instance in particular has afforded states a wide degree of latitude or flexibility in developing these plans, recognizing that states are best equipped to figure out what are the most cost-effective and otherwise preferred measures for achieving the reductions that EPA is requiring of us. Once states develop those plans, we submit them to EPA for review and approval. And in this case, EPA anticipates that then compliance will begin starting in 2020. You'll recall from the previous slide I mentioned that state plans are due as late as 2018, so compliance beginning in 2020 creeps up pretty quickly. But EPA anticipates that compliance, ultimate compliance with the emission reduction targets, won't be achieved until 2030, or at least won't be required until 2030. So this slide explains the emission guideline that EPA has developed in their proposal. And In this case, EPA has defined or broken up their emission guideline into four building blocks, as they refer to it. Recall that they're directed to identify all adequately demonstrated measures to reduce emissions, in this case, CO2 from existing power plants. And they've identified four groupings of measures that can be used by states to reduce those emissions. And I'm going to briefly walk through these because it's real important to understand the range of emission reduction targets that EPA is contemplating, because those are in turn likely going to be the measures that states are most likely to choose in our plans. So starting from the left there with building block one, that building block includes the emission reductions that EPA considers feasible for states to achieve by making energy or operational efficiencies at existing coal plants. And EPA's data suggests that on average, coal plants could have their efficiency or heat rates improved by about 6% on average. In the case of Oregon, I'll tell you now, block one is largely academic. It effectively gets wiped out with the application of block two, which is the emission reductions that could be achieved within each state by shifting generation at the coal plants in the state to, as EPA refers to them, underutilized natural gas plants within the state. In the case of Oregon, as you may know, we have one coal plant in Boardman, and we have quite a few existing natural gas plants. And again, using the data that EPA did to construct their proposal, they've identified enough available capacity at natural gas plants here in Oregon to shift all of that power at Boardman to the natural gas plants. And I should note, natural gas is about twice as efficient on an emissions per megawatt hour of generation basis as coal. There's about, in other words, natural gas emits about half as much CO2 as coal per megawatt hour. Blocks three and four seek to reduce demand on existing coal and natural gas power plants. In the case of block three, that reducing demand on coal and gas by shifting to renewable energy. And in the case of block four, shifting lowering demand on coal and natural gas by simply lowering our overall electricity demand through end-use energy efficiency. So again, each of these four blocks gets added up, and the reductions from those blocks get applied to the states and added together to produce an overall statewide emission rate target. And in the case of Oregon, using the data that EPA chose, they used 2012 data to characterize states' existing conditions. And in 2012, using that data, Oregon's average emission rate was 717 pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour generated that year. And applying those four building blocks produces a 48% reduction down to 372 pounds CO2 per megawatt hour. And that would be the rate that we'd be required if this proposal were final. That's the rate we would have to hit by 2030.
So was 2012, why was that year chosen?
At the time, it was the most, with the time of the proposal, it was the most recent year of that they had all the data available from the Energy Information Administration. That was the data set that they were using.
And just is it agnostic in terms of how much you get from each block per state? I mean, how much reduction you get in emissions from each block?
Madam Chair, if I understand the question correctly, it is each block is attempting to do the same thing with each state. And take the block two example that I described earlier. EPA looks at the amount of coal generation in a given state and says how much of that generation can be shifted to existing natural gas capacity within that state. And they say all the gas plants, I believe the details are that all the gas plants could be operated at 70% level. So if they're operating below that level, using that 2012 data again, they say let's shift that coal into that remaining capacity. So they do that same sort of calculus with each state. But if a state, for instance, has very little natural gas but quite a lot of coal, the data would suggest there's very little capacity to shift from coal to gas.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess question looking at this, because we're going with Oregon's 2012 emission rate. Where are we federally right now at 2012? And I mean, how far are we below what the federal guidelines are to where we are? And then the numbers we're trying to hit. And I guess the other question I would have on top of that is, what are we going to do to rates when we go strictly to natural gas? Because we've seen natural gas rates go through the roof here when California was having rolling blackouts and everything else. So if we give up coal completely, we're putting our main source of energy into one commodity, and I don't see that as being a good thing, but if you could let me know where we are right now as far as our emission rates compared to the federal standards and right. where you want to go, how far below the federal standards we're going to be.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I don't have that data, the national level data, at my disposal right now. We can certainly get back to you with that information. I do know that, generally speaking, Oregon's existing and targeted rates are below the national average. We are quite a lot cleaner in general here in the Northwest and in Oregon than many other parts of the country. I should also note, in response to your second question about transitioning entirely to natural gas, that this is simply the emission guideline here and is simply EPA's tool to prescribe prescribe states emission rate reductions required. It does not prescribe how we get there. Again, we're given quite a lot of flexibility to decide as a state how we want to get there. So we may decide we don't want to put all our eggs in that natural gas basket and decide we may want to invest more in renewables and diversify our energy portfolio that way.
Representative Gordon.
Our emission rate, I think, varies from year to year, depending on water levels, weather conditions, and so forth. Do you know if that was a high emission rate year or low or?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, that was a low emission rate year, as I understand it. That it was a high hydro year, meaning we had higher than average hydroelectric generation that year, meaning that we relied less on fossil generation resources that year.
Follow up. So does that mean it will be even possibly harder to achieve the 48% reduction?
As I understand it, it could mean that, yes.
Okay.
It would make the reduction more stringent. Yep.
Thank you.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you may be getting to this in the balance of your presentation, but it would be super interesting to know the guess at cost of all of this. But setting that aside, I'm more interested in comparing what our goal is to California's, and I was just trying to find it here. But do you have that number?
I do not. I evidently should have brought those numbers with me. I believe California's reduction, if I recall, is less than ours. Oregon's that 48% reduction, at least on a percentage basis, on an absolute basis, you can imagine it's quite a lot higher. But the percentage, our 48% is one of the highest. I think it's maybe third or fourth.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
The number I'm staring at it looks like 23% for California. We have 48. Mm-hmm. That's not the intuitive thought I would have. So I guess I just want to know if there's, in your opinion, a difference in ratepayer cost between California and Oregon as a result of those different standards.
Representative Benz, Madam Chair, it's impossible to speculate there because states have very different tools at their disposal to achieve these reductions. I know that, for instance, there are states that are heavily reliant on coal and have relatively little infrastructure policy and otherwise in place to invest in renewables and energy efficiency that may have relatively modest reduction goals, but because they are not, I'm going to get to this actually in my next slide, because they are situated in a very differently than us as far as current trajectory in investing in renewables and energy efficiency, they may find it a much heavier lift to achieve a smaller reduction than we might.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, thank you. I guess what I'm struggling with is, I just need to know, do you think that any of these numbers, the 48% or the 23%, were determined when it comes to the return on the investment it's going to take to achieve those goals, or was this done with an entirely different goal in mind? And if so, what is that? What is that measure of good?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I think I understand it better now, your question. As far as cost is concerned, EPA is directed by Section 111D of the Clean Air Act to consider cost. So when they determine, for instance, that on average coal plants could have their efficiency improved by 6%, at least in theory, I don't know the details of how that one individual block was constructed, but in each of those blocks, they had to consider the cost of the investment. So, for instance, they determined that carbon capture and sequestration at every coal plant was not cost effective. Otherwise, that would have been included in block one. They would have prescribed that on average every coal plant could have carbon capture attached to it. So embedded in each of those blocks is a consideration of the cost, generally speaking.
Madam Chair, I have one more follow-up. What I'm most concerned about here is this. And I know you're taking this into account, but I need to be clear on how you're doing that. And that is the people of Oregon know what they're getting in return for the investment the federal government is asking them to make in these types of changes in technology. It's just so important that we don't, and you may be getting to that in your remaining presentation, but what I'm going to be most interested in is an explanation from the departments of how the people of Oregon are kept informed of the cost of this activity. That's hugely important to me, and by cost I mean how many more dollars out of their pocket and what we as a state are receiving in return for that investment. Do you anticipate that that's going to be possible, or how difficult is that going to be as we go through this?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I anticipate, or I certainly hope that that will be possible, that we will be able to estimate the cost. It's hard to imagine that we would be able to enact any rulemaking, much less legislation, without an estimate of the fiscal and economic impacts of whatever we elect to do as a state in our state plan. And we anticipate continuing outreach with stakeholders and redoubled efforts, frankly, once we have a final rule in front of us and we begin in earnest developing our state plan.
Madam Chair, if I may, this is not a question. Is to comment on the legislation. It's almost as though there should be a person on that committee that's employed by the media and does nothing but get the word out, because this is a great big expensive deal, and knowing how complex it is, it would be so important that we somehow make sure people know what's happening. So it's a big deal.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think actually Representative Benz is right on with that, because the other thing that I'm looking at, we're looking at a starting point where we're already less than everybody else. I mean, you said it across the nation, and we're looking at 48%. So if we're already below everybody else at 30%, and now we're trying to do 48%, we're putting a lot of our industry possibly at a competitive disadvantage in some of the tools that we have for keeping businesses here and keeping low power rates for our families in the state of Oregon, our low-income families. We could be destroying that if we're not careful. So, I mean, as you're doing this, I would like to know where the starting point is for every state, because it's easy to say, well, California, well, their starting point's a lot higher. They're 30% higher than we are, and we're trying to go 48%, where they're coming down to 23%, and they still don't hit our level with where they're at. So these are things that we need to gather, and you might be going into it on further slides, but things are very, very crucial for us to look at this committee as well as we go forward with this.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, we can certainly provide details on the starting points and target emission rates for each state. That is readily available. I simply don't have it right in front of me. And I am going to get into the next slide some of the tools that are already in place here in Oregon that actually align very closely with the three of the four building blocks that really apply to our state, that suggest that maybe it is not the same. It is not a fair representation to simply look at those percentages, that 23% versus the 48%. But you also have to look at what's in place in the state already. What are they already equipped to do to begin to reduce their emissions? I think the next slide speaks to that a little bit.
Representative Polby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to step back, I guess one spot here. These are proposed guidelines, as I understand it, and there's already been some input from the state of Oregon to re-examine the initial 2012 emission rate that they would consider a larger space and time overall. So that would change all of those figures, including the 48% reduction, if in fact those final rules reflect a five-year average, for example, or something, some other base rate besides the 2012 emission rate. And is there any indication that the EPA is considering changing that base emission rate?
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, you're absolutely right, first on the fact that that would change both the starting conditions as, that the EPA characterizes states with, as well as the targets and the ultimate stringency. If they were to use a five-year average, that might raise our starting emission rate as well as our target. And, that, and certainly the argument has been made by many parties that a multi-year average would be a more indicative of states' starting conditions, given the year-to-year variations that are prevalent in the electricity sector, in particular here in the Northwest with our reliance on hydro. And in fact, we have heard from EPA that they have received this message loud and clear, and that the comments that they've received on the use of a single-year baseline have been relatively consistent, that they have that those comments have suggested that that was not the best approach, that a multi-year approach would, again, provide that more indicative starting condition for, really for pretty much any state.
Follow-up.
Just follow-up. So these figures are a little bit scarier than what may actually end up happening.
Perhaps there's a lot of moving parts here. That's just one of them. So this is absolutely a proposal, and the only thing we're certain of is that it will change.
Thank you,
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, I think from the line of questioning from Representative Bentz, you know, I really think Oregonians would like to believe that their state agencies are actively engaging on behalf of Oregonians regarding actions at the federal level that could have a very serious impact on our lifestyle and on just what it means to live here. So are you saying then in regards to Representative Hoyle's or Holvey's question that
got a promotion.
That wasn't a promotion, was it?
you
and or your office are actively engaged with EPA in trying to intercede and hopefully get them to land in a rational place at the end of this process. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I would say that is correct, yes. And actually, one of the things that we'll get into that Andy and Jason in particular will speak to are some of the comments that we provided to EPA. Many of those comments are directed at EPA to hopefully change or clarify the final rule in a way that recognizes the unique power sector characteristics here in Oregon. There's a lot of we as a state and as a region have very different characteristics here in the Northwest than, for instance, parts of the Northeast and other parts of the country. And our comments are really directed at EPA to help hopefully form the final rule in a way that makes a lot more sense for the way things operate here.
Thank you.
Okay, and go ahead, because I think some of the questions are getting into material that you're going to cover there. So.
All right. So as I mentioned, this slide just draws some parallels between the three building blocks that apply here in Oregon, blocks 2, 3, and 4, and policies that are already in place here in Oregon. So just starting with the second block, again, that's the amount of emission reductions that EPA envisions for could be achieved by shifting from coal generation to gas. Here in Oregon, as you may know, the one coal power plant we have here in Boardman is already planned for closure by the end of 2020, which is very near the beginning of the compliance period that EPA anticipates. Building block 3, which deals with renewable energy, we happen to have in place already a renewable portfolio standard that requires certain minimum levels of renewable energy to be acquired by our largest utilities. And then building block 4 is especially important for us, as we are one of the leading states in acquisition of energy efficiency through investments from PGE and PacifiCorp ratepayers to the Energy Trust of Oregon, as well as investments by the Bonneville Power Administration in the public utility territories. So again, this is just to illustrate the fact that as a state, we already have policies in place that align somewhat anyway with the different elements of EPA's emission management. And so now, we're going to transition into explaining what the input that we have provided to EPA in our comment letter. As I mentioned, EPA opened a comment period immediately following their proposal in June, and DEQ, Department of Energy, and PUC worked together jointly to develop a comment letter to EPA in that period. And in the letter, we expressed broad support for a national carbon regulation for the power sector, and strong support in particular for EPA developing a standard standard that accounts for the emission reductions that can be acquired from renewable energy and energy efficiency. That said, given that support, we spent the majority of the letter providing requests or recommendations for changes or clarifications in the final rule. And to describe some of the more significant recommendations, I'm going to hand it over first to Andy.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs Reed in and Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis at the Oregon Department of Energy. And I'll begin by saying that our comments were largely driven by two important characteristics of the power system in the Northwest, some of which have already been anticipated by your questions. So first, as you'll recall from our Energy 101 presentation last week, about a third of Oregon's electric load is served by hydropower from the Bonneville Power Administration. So this chart, which you saw before, shows the utilities in Oregon, the white areas are their investor-owned utilities like PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric, and the colored areas are the consumer-owned utilities. And most of the power that's provided by the consumer-owned utilities comes from the Bonneville power system, hydropower, which is already zero carbon. So as Colin explained a minute ago, Block 4 of the BEST system of emission reductions, which sets our target, is basically energy efficiency on the energy system in Oregon. And when EPA calculated how much reductions we can get from Block 4, they looked at all areas of the state, not just the white areas, which have a mix of generating sources, but also the colored areas, which are largely hydropower and to some extent nuclear. And so they considered the potential for reduction on our whole load. And so at first, Blash, you might say this makes no sense. How can doing energy efficiency on the hydro system, which is already zero emission, how can that reduce emissions? And actually, it does make sense because when you do energy efficiency on the hydro system, basically you free up a hydropower which can offset fossil fuel emissions elsewhere in the system. However, most of those reductions are not going to occur in Oregon. They're going to be reductions in fossil fuel generation in other states. So that creates a problem for us because the way EPA proposed the rule, we can only take credit for emission reductions in our compliance plan that occur in our state. So that is the basis for one of our most important comments that Jason will explain in a moment. But we think that this mismatch between how they handled setting the target and how they allow us to comply with the target really came from a fundamental misunderstanding of how the power system works in the Northwest. So we spent a large part of our comments explaining that to them, and we're hopeful that they'll understand it. Jason will explain it more in a minute. The second important characteristic of our power system is that while we're a net exporter of power overall, we're a net importer of fossil power in our state. So this map shows the power sources that serve our load, and you can see it's multi-state. The coal plants are shown in gray, natural gas plants are in orange, and the windmills are in dark blue. And so note the number of fossil fuel power plants that serve our load that are located in other states like Utah, Wyoming, and Montana. So because of this, when we do energy efficiency on the investor-owned utility system, much of that emission reduction is going to occur actually in another state where those fossil fuel plants are located. So similar to the hydro system where we would, under the original proposal, we would get no credit for energy efficiency on the consumer-owned utility system, even in the investor-owned areas, we would only get partial credit for the reductions there because some of that will occur in state and some will occur out of state. So this also shows that is we import and export a fair amount of renewable power that's generated in Oregon. And because much of the renewable power that serves our load is located out of state, it's also important that we get credit for the renewable power that is in other states that our consumers have paid for and that serves their load. So again, these are characteristics of our power system that led to our main comments. So I'm going to first describe our comments on Block 3, and then Jason will go into a lot more detail on Block 4, which is where we spent most of the time in our comments. So turning to our comments on renewable energy in Block 3, EPA's proposal for using renewable energy does in fact recognize that the interconnected nature of our system. And so basically, in short, EPA got it right from our perspective on the renewable energy side. Their proposal allows states to take credit for emission reductions from renewable power that serves our load regardless of where that power is located. So we supported that approach in the rule because it would ensure that the ratepayers who fund the development of those plants in other states gets the value of those investments, and that our state receives credit for those investments. Also, it would allow the renewable portfolio standard to be our main compliance tool, as Colin had pointed out, and allows us to use our existing tracking system, which is the Western Renewable Energy Generation Information System, or REGIS, to track compliance with 111D. So it's from our perspective, EPA got it basically right, although, of course, we had some detailed comments for them on renewable energy, but the basic setup was correct. But it's important to know that other states don't agree with that. For example, Montana, in their comments, argued the exact opposite and said that states should get credit for the renewable energy that's generated in their state, regardless of where that power is used. So EPA's received comments in both directions on this from states. We don't know how they'll come out on it. Presumably, they're going to have to balance competing state interests. So that's where we are in Block 3, and now I'm going to turn it over to Jason to talk about Block 4.
Chair Vega-Peterson, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorf, Utility Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. It's good to see you all again. I'm going to harken back to something that Colin said initially, is that when EPA made its four building blocks, they were structured in a way that corresponds relatively well with the policies that we have in the state. So, for example, if it were structured such that we could take full credit for the retirement of Boardman in 2020, we take full credit for the renewable portfolio standard and the development of renewable energy in Block 3, and we could take full credit for the energy efficiency that the Energy Trust and BPA acquire for Block 4, we would be in reasonably good shape. A core element of our comments, however, is that we don't think that the EPA got it right on energy efficiency. So when Andy and I were here, I think it was last Tuesday, doing the survey of the energy sector, I made reference to the EPA doing something dumb, and that was not just a gratuitous dig at government. They have a proposal for energy efficiency that does not work very well for the state of Oregon, and it is a complicated issue, and I'm not really going to go into it except to say this, is that EPA has a disconnect between how they established our Block 4 energy efficiency goal and how they then tell Oregon in particular how we can comply, how we can meet that goal. And Andy made reference to it. Their primary proposal in the draft is that in order to take credit for energy efficiency, we need to track that back to fossil fuel generation in the state of Oregon. That is that's hard to do. We are a net exporter of energy, given the federal hydro system, according to EPA. But we are also a net importer of fossil fuel generation through primarily the Pacific Corp system, but also PGE. So when we sort of went through our calculations, we determined that if we were to track back, as the draft proposal states, energy efficiency to particular resources in Oregon, that would only allow us to take credit for about 15% of the energy efficiency in the state. Clearly, that's not going to get us there. So one of the key issues that we talked to EPA about in our letter was this disconnect that makes this very difficult for us. So the Oregon recommendation there at the bottom that we made to EPA is pretty simple and pretty elegant.
If a state invests in energy efficiency within that state gets to take credit for it for compliance purposes. We know that there are some folks in the Northeast who have a different take on this, and actually I think I might mention this. I only have three slides, and their third slide, I think we can go a little bit more into that. It's a simple and elegant solution. We'll see where EPA ultimately ends up, but this is pretty critical to the state of Oregon being able to comply with the goal that EPA has set. A less scary issue, but one that is important to us also, is EPA was not really clear on the full range of energy efficiency that a state could use to comply. The Northwest, the Northwest, but also Oregon in particular, has an excellent history of energy efficiency acquisition, and the recommendation to the EPA is, to the extent that code standards and market transformation are above federal standards, we should be able to take credit for those also toward compliance. And then finally, multi-state agreements. A particularly loud voice in the development of the EPA draft rule came from the Northeast. This is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. This is REGGIE. This is a cap and trade program amongst a number of Northeast states, where they basically are. It's on the electricity sector, this cap and trade program in the Northeast. And so one of the things that EPA wanted to do was encourage the states to come forward and be able to take credit for those kinds of programs. REGGIE was pretty vocal in this, and so the version of the multi-state agreement that EPA talked about in its draft letter was the kind of multi-state agreement where multiple states come together and pool their obligation in a program. And if that program went ahead and was successful and met the obligations of the individual states, everyone was, the individual state didn't have to do anything. The program just had to do something. In the West, we tend to be a little bit more independent-minded than that. We thought it was pretty unlikely that either in the Northwest or the Pacific Corp states, for example, the states would come together and do a full pooling of obligation like that. And so one of the recommendations we made to EPA was to recognize a range of multi-state agreements, everything from what's going on in the Northeast to something that's a little less unified, more of a coalition approach. And these multi-state agreements are valuable because they can reduce the costs of compliance for participating states. We just want to make sure that EPA recognizes that there are multiple ways of coming together as in a multi-state program.
Okay, for the record again, this is Colin McConaughey. I'm just going to wrap up with one last slide here just on the next steps that we anticipate over the coming months before leading up to EPA issuing their final rule. We anticipate actually being able to continue a dialogue with EPA. They have been pretty amazing for no other reason in this process than their outreach has been unprecedented, as I understand it, from folks who have tracked EPA rulemaking far longer than I have. They have engaged states and stakeholders quite a lot in this process and continue to do so, even though they are in the final phases of developing the rule. So we'll continue that dialogue with EPA, and we also continue, as our three agencies continue to work together to now beginning to figure out what are some potential compliance approaches that we could consider as a state, and we hope to reach out to our state stakeholders again and engage them on that topic, so that even though this is all very hypothetical at this point, not knowing what's in the final rule, when that final rule is published, we hope that our progress over the next few months positions us well to hit the ground running in developing that final plan, because a year comes by, it passes very quickly when developing something this complex. Again, EPA is expected to issue their rule later this summer. And when they do that, then, as I mentioned earlier, we'll redouble our efforts in working with stakeholders to develop that plan. At the very least, that state, our state plan will require a rulemaking process with our Environmental Quality Commission, as well as a rulemaking process for any other rules that come about because of the plan. And throughout all of this, of course, we are committed to updating legislature on request. And with that, I think we'll just turn it over to questions.
Representative Holby.
Just one real basic question. Don't suppose Oregon has any choice in the matter of whether they end up complying with whatever the rules are or not.
Madam Chair, Representative, it is a requirement. It would be a regulation imposed on us, as every other state. In fact, we understand recently from EPA that they are developing what is called a federal implementation plan that would provide a backstop, essentially. If should states not submit a plan or submit an approvable plan, this federal implementation plan would be imposed on the state.
Thank you.
So, and I just had a question about the that was on the slide under other energy efficiency issues. It seems like the recommendation to receive credit for the full range of the efficiency measures, even if they're in consumer-owned utilities, makes sense because, as you had said earlier, we're being, all of the emissions that happen in the consumer owner are still being counted in terms of our total. So that just seems to add some consistency on that, and I don't know if that was part of your comments or not, but.
Madam Chair, that's exactly consistent with our comment, and not only would it recognize the significant investments that consumer-owned utilities and their ratepayers and the Bonneville Power Administration are making on energy efficiency, it also takes advantage of those emission reduction credits that are occurring and would otherwise be left on the table. So it would really raise the cost, overall cost for the nation to not consider the reductions on the hydro system and how those can be used to offset fossil generation somewhere else on the system merely because the reductions occur in a different state. To EPA's defense, part of the state-by-state approach that they came up with is dictated by the way the Clean Air Act is written. They can't mandate states to do a multi-state plan. They can only put it out there as an option and create incentives for it. So it's possible that by requiring states to only take credit for reductions that occur within their boundaries, they were trying to create an incentive for states to join in a multi-state plan without mandating it. But as Jason said, that sort of all or nothing approach is unlikely to work in the West, and so we encourage them to continue with their overall commitment to flexibility for states, and just make more options available so we have the most cost-effective compliance.
Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, you guys need to give us the temperature of this proposal from the federal government. Is it something that overstates what we need to do, understates what we need to do, is just right, in your guys' opinion? And the reason I say that is, having been engaged in writing rules for the 8 years I was on the Water Resource Commission, I understand the flexibility that's given to a department in doing that. And I just want to know what you guys' underlying theme thinking is when you see what they're asking of us. Is it overreaching as all get out? Is it just way too little? What is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I think that's a very tough question to answer until we have the final rule in front of us. The significant difference in how we might respond to that should EPA give us, if you will, what we're asking for in our comment letter or not. Really means we need to wait and see how they finalize the rule.
Madam Chair, if I may, pretend or not, pretend they ignore us.
Then I think we would be put in a position that would require us to work with our neighboring states from which we import power. The states that Andy mentioned, like Montana, Utah, Wyoming, the states that from which we import fossil generation, would be very appealing partners for us.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, here's sort of another attempt at answering your question, which is EPA could have stopped at block one, which was just requiring efficiencies at a coal plant. That looks like a couple of percent reduction in greenhouse gas emissions across the nation. So for that, and there are some legitimate other reasons why they decided actually to go outside the fence. We call it outside the fence of the coal plant. Once they did that, they started looking at the entire, once you go outside the fence, you're looking at the entire electricity sector. And once you do that, on the one hand, you can get significantly larger greenhouse gas reductions, but the program becomes infinitely more complicated. And so some of the issues that we're talking about, cross-border issues, these are things that EPA now has to wrestle with. The initial rulemaking was a decent stab, I suppose, for a federal agency that's not really an electricity agency to factor in a whole bunch of moving pieces. How many comments did they get back?
We heard a little over 2 million.
2 million comments they got. And so at this point, we're in another place where we have to do a wait and see what actually comes out at the other end, because there are some things that they won't change in the draft rule, and I think there are some things that they clearly will.
Madam Chair, I haven't heard from Mr. Ginsburg.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, I don't really have anything to add. I think that I would just agree with what my colleague said.
Thank you. Sorry. It's
okay. Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Direct this to any or all three of you, but what I'm thinking about is the process, and I think this came up, was alluded to a little bit earlier, about how do we make this work? Because I think it's extremely important what we're embarking upon, and the concern is including as many people into the process as possible. I know you folks have been working together. What I don't know is, do you just go and kind of get in your respective cubes and kind of work, or how do you get the public involved? How do you inform the public? You said something about, well, we'll report to the legislature when asked. That didn't sound like, really being very inclusive, and so I'm really concerned about. I mean, there may just be great ideas out there for how we address this as a state. And so how do we get as many people involved? Would your process, if we didn't have a task force, would your process allow a lot of input?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, that is a great question, and you're right. I don't think we fully addressed that anywhere in the presentation. Merely alluded to it in the planning process here in Oregon, and utilized by DEQ and I think many or most other state agencies. It is probably one of the more inclusive public processes, as I understand it. As a planner myself, the Oregon has often touted itself as being a very inclusive state in our planning processes, and I think the processes that at least I can speak for DEQ that we engage in any kind of rulemaking really go above and beyond what's required of us by state law or by federal law in this case, and those involve the usual tools I think you're probably accustomed to, which are public notices, public hearings. Those are all a part of our rulemaking process. And as I mentioned, at the very least, our state plan will go through a rulemaking process led by our Environmental Quality Commission. But I would go further than that and say that even before that, or even now and prior to the end of the comment period and during the development of our comment letter, our agencies have been working with I think a pretty broad cross-section of stakeholders at any rate, if not broadly soliciting comment from the public about what are the considerations that we should be weighing and thinking about. The comment letter that we developed was absolutely informed by our stakeholder engagement process, in which I think we had a slide up here that listed just very broadly the groups of stakeholders that we're working with. Do you want
to? Madam Chair, if I could add also, our engagement with the stakeholders has been on many different levels. We have very sophisticated utilities who have modeling capabilities and knowledge of how ability to determine how this rule would affect their power system and run scenarios and options and give us information back about how various compliance options could affect their systems. And all the way to more general public stakeholders who wouldn't have that kind of sophistication. So we have had outreach on many, many different levels. We've had one-on-one meetings with each of the utilities. We've had group meetings with the utilities, the independent power providers, all of the interested stakeholders in the renewable energy community, in the environmental community. We've met with many of them one-on-one. We've met with them multiple times in groups. And it's just the beginning of our outreach, but that was just to inform our comments, to try and understand what EPA's proposal would do. I don't think we mentioned how many pages long the proposal was. Colin, do you have that on top of your head?
I believe the proposal itself was 680-something in my head, but there are hundreds, if not thousands, more in technical documentation.
So, just understanding the proposal really required a collaboration with all of those stakeholders. And that was to inform our comments. How will this rule affect Oregon? And what what specifically do we need from EPA to make it feasible for us to comply? And also considering how it affects other states, because it has to work for every. This rule has to work for everyone. But now moving into the planning process to come up with options for how we could comply. One of the key points I think we've been trying to make is that we don't have to comply with this rule in the same way that EPA used those building blocks. They use those building blocks to come up with what the requirement is. We can look at that, but it may be more cost effective for us to use a different mix of options and even some options that EPA didn't consider in the building blocks. And we, again, will need to reach out to the stakeholders to find out what all those options are, how they would affect everyone, what the cost would be. So we're planning probably the most extensive stakeholder involvement process of any rulemaking that I've been involved with in 25 years of working for the state of Oregon. So I think you can be confident that we'll be engaging stakeholders and that we won't wait until just being asked, but we'll plan to regularly brief you on our progress. So I'm expecting that during the interim we'll be asked to make presentations, and we'll be happy to keep you posted all along the way of our progress and coming up with a compliance plan.
Thank you very much.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Some good news. Everybody's such a downer today anyway. This just in from Oregon State, go Beavs. They found a way to take carbon dioxide and make a fuel out of it, fueling everything they say from defibrillators to hybrid electric cars. That in combination with the carbon storage up in Saskatchewan with their Nobel Prize winning Dr. Morris at the University of Regina is really some good news. And not to diminish anybody's work, I think it's kind of a race to the top here, and it's very positive, I think. So we have to keep that in mind and looking at Representative Grumpy over there. Yeah, they're all going to point at everybody else.
It's obviously you.
But I just thought that I'd spread a little cheer.
Thank you, Representative Boone, for this.
Those beavers, those engineers down there, really didn't get me.
Representative Holby.
I'm trying to remember what my question was. And looking at, getting beyond, the point where we're actually figured out a plan for compliance, I got to imagine that there's going to be an impact to ratepayers at some level. And I would also imagine that there's the potential for a lot of disparate impacts depending on what region of the state you're in or what utility is supplying your power. And so has there been some thought or conversation into is it fair that one group of ratepayers are going to be impacted much more than others because they didn't really choose, you know, this rule, or they didn't really, have this in mind when they live in a particular area. So has there been much thought about, you know, are we going to try to mitigate that cost to ratepayers to spread it throughout the state, or are the ratepayers of one particular utility just going to suffer much more than others? Or is the EPA going to balance that for us?
That sounds like a Jason question.
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, it sounds like a cop out, but it still depends. It still depends upon ultimately what the rule says. One of the issues is, for example, energy efficiency, and is energy efficiency in consumer owned territories part of the compliance or not? EPA made it part of the block, and so. It's those kinds of moving pieces that we're not really sure about at this point. Again, I would emphasize the point that given our history of energy policy in this state, given the fact that PGE is closing down, I think Boardman gets us almost halfway to the goal, closing down all by itself. Depending upon what EPA does, and if they do things that make it easy for us, we can do this. We can get there, and it won't be significantly more than the kinds of policies that you have already set us on a trajectory for. If EPA chooses to take different directions, then yes, I think there could be a rate impact, and there could be a differential between utility ratepayers, depending upon their utility.
I consider that a cop out.
I could add one thing. There's also the potential for rate impacts across states. As we keep saying that, our power system is interconnected, and decisions that are made in the states from which we import power could affect our rates as well, and certainly could raise issues for how rates are set and costs are allocated among states. So it is extremely complex, and we don't know how that will come out, but it is something really important to pay attention to. I think we've talked about it as an issue. We haven't, because the rule is just proposed and not final yet. We haven't gone too far down that path of figuring out how would we mitigate that. But I'm certain that as we consider options for compliance, once we know what the final rule is, that will have to be a front and center question. How is this going to fall across different regions of our state to make sure that it's equitable?
Thank you. That was a good answer.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony, as well as for all the work that you've done in putting together the responses and going through exactly what was being asked. I know that you are eagerly awaiting the final rulemaking in mid-July or end July, as are we, and so I'm sure we'll look forward to seeing you again the first legislative days once those rules come out. So thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Okay. So we do have a few people signed up to testify on House Bill 2191, so I'm going to go ahead and call up Angus Duncan, Wendy Gerlitz, and Mike Fries. Welcome. When you're ready, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. Okay. So, Madam Chair, my name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation in Portland, and I chair the State of Oregon Global Mining Commission. I do want to just observe in passing, given some of the comments about the need to pull Oregonians into the circle of folks who are at least contemplating what kinds of impacts this regulation is going to be like, Section 111D has been a concern and a focus of the Global Warming Commission since at least a year ago, before the draft rule came out. And the Global Warming Commission itself is a pretty wide cross-section of folks who are concerned with energy and environmental issues. Sort of everybody from Intel to a couple of utility CEOs to the environmental community to forestry to ag. And we have also actively taken this issue out, speaking to audiences around the state and trying to pull public participation in so that folks do understand, at least at a superficial level, what this rule potentially can do either for them or to them or both. With respect to the legislation, I have sort of three comments. In summary, they are that I think that the legislature should be engaged with this issue, more than it is, and however that can be best accomplished, I would encourage you to be so engaged. It's not clear to me whether legislation is necessary or not, but one way or another, the legislature needs to get its head and its hands around the issues raised by 111D. And finally, if the committee and the legislature choose to go ahead with the legislation, there are probably a couple of small fixes that I would recommend. So if I can enlarge on those just briefly, and most particularly the reasons that the legislature needs to be engaged with this, some of the questions from the committee today I think have really been excellent and at least are pointed in the right direction, but there tends to be an inclination when one is looking at the question of cost impacts to start and stop with the cost of compliance. And while the cost of compliance is a really significant question, there are some other cost dimensions that need to be addressed by the legislature and by the staff in its engagement with the EPA. There are not just the costs of compliance, but there are the costs of failing to comply, or even more to the point, of failing to get ahead of the kinds of actions we will need to comply. If we don't take these actions until we absolutely have to, it's distinctly possible that the costs are going to be higher than if we did get ahead of them. And frankly, a great example of that is the Boardman settlement, which was done before I think anybody anticipated that there would be a Section 111D rulemaking. But the Boardman settlement discussions, which were I think a real example of Oregon decision making at its best, engaged stakeholders, engaged Portland General Electric, engaged the state staff, ended up basically saving ratepayers about $450 million that otherwise would have been spent to retrofit the plant. So that's $450 in stranded costs that we will not have to watch go away potentially because of a rulemaking such as 111D. We got ahead of the issue there. We saved the ratepayers a lot of money. We probably saved them more money than we thought we were saving them because we at least anticipated that there was a risk of carbon regulation, and that anticipation turned out to be accurate. And I think we should assume that the 111D regulation that is being proposed, is far from the last word from either the federal government or potentially from state governments or state voters on where we need to go to contain carbon emissions. We do need to talk, and I really appreciated the comment, Representative Holvey, about the distributive effects of this, because they are potentially uneven, not just utility to utility, but also consumer to consumer. If the cost, the near-term costs of compliance, result in a rate increase, that's going to fall disproportionately on low-income households for whom energy costs are a larger proportion of their budget. It's also, interestingly, probably going to create a disproportionate distribution of cost to some of the businesses in this state, especially ones that are engaged in the commodity business, where energy is a significant input to their cost of product, and where, because they are largely price takers in national and global markets, they have a limited capacity to pass those costs on. So anticipating not just the cost, but the distribution of costs is an important part of I think the state's responsibilities, my commission's responsibilities, and the legislature's responsibilities. And there are, of course, also just the costs of coping with climate change if we fail to arrest it at some reasonable level. And I won't go into those in great detail because that would take, you know, way too long. With respect to whether the legislation is necessary or not, as I say, I defer to the committee and the legislature on this. I will say that at least from my perspective, the state agencies have been inclusive and very forthcoming, at least in engaging with interested stakeholders. And, you know, we feel like our access to them has been excellent. I think, you know, Wendy can speak to the environmental community. You know, I know the utilities are regularly engaged. When my commission developed its own comments to EPA, we were supported extensively in doing so by state staff, and we also aligned those comments generally with those of both the environmental community and the utilities, and we're able to do that. And I think it is to the credit of the state staffs that Oregon's comments generally are pretty aligned in going back to EPA. Finally, if you decide to go ahead with the bill, the couple of changes I would suggest you look at. First, this sets some very specific intervals for reporting. While I understand the logic behind that in terms of the legislative calendar, it's probably useful to remember that EPA's calendar will not necessarily align with yours, that EPA has already announced that its expected final rule in June of this year is going to come later than June of this year, and they didn't specify when. So you could end up, if the calendar is too rigid, you could end up with a report that's supposed to be a final report that comes out before we know what EPA proposes to do. So you should just look at some flexibility with that. Finally, with respect to the makeup of the task force, at the risk of appearing self-interested, I would encourage you to consider the Global Warming Commission because we've been heavily engaged in this issue, and we connect with a lot of constituencies. I would also suggest that in addition to the utilities and consumers, that the environmental community has also been heavily involved with this issue and probably needs to be reflected on the task force. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Wendy Gerlitz, and I am Policy Director for the Northwest Energy Coalition. We are a membership organization that promotes clean and affordable energy throughout the Northwest. And we have members that include utilities, environmental organizations, ratepayer advocates, low-income advocates, and environmental and energy-related businesses, clean energy businesses. So we're a pretty diverse coalition. Angus likes to put me in the environmental camp. But I'm gonna say we're a little more diverse than that. But we do promote clean and affordable energy, and we have been working a great deal on the Clean Power Plan. We submitted comments on the draft plan to EPA, which actually mirrored quite closely in some regards the agencies from Oregon's comments as well. The high points that they hit were also in common points that we hit in our comments. And we were engaged in discussions in all four of our states, Montana, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. Don't tell anybody in the other states, but I do want to say that Oregon's process was the best by far. And I'm talking about the stakeholder process and their technical analysis. I can tell you honestly that I had agency folks from other states calling me and asking me questions that I would answer with information that I received from our state agencies, and I passed that information along to them to answer questions. So I was very impressed with the great job that the agencies did here, both at including a broad swath of stakeholders, but also the technical analysis. Excuse me. The coalition takes the position that the EPA's Clean Power Plan is an important step for reducing nationwide CO2 emissions. We also think that Oregon's strong record on clean energy policy positions us really well to to comply with the rule. You know, you heard a lot of uncertainties about what the final rule is going to look like, and I will agree that, you know, depending on the direction that EPO goes, it will change some of our ability to comply. But in general, we're on a pretty good pathway. So one message that I want to convey is we need to continue our momentum on that clean energy policy. You know, the things that we've already been doing, our energy efficiency, our RPS, those things are going to put us in a very good place for compliance relative to a lot of the other states. So we need to continue that momentum this session and beyond. With regard to this specific legislation that we're discussing today, we were very excited to see the interest of the legislature on the Clean Power Plan. This is a pretty detailed, you know, 650-page, you heard it, plus all the technical documents. But we do think it's a really important thing for the legislature to be aware of and engaged in the discussions. However, with regard to a task force, we would just caution you that it's pretty early in the game to be putting together a task force. That, you know, the final rule isn't set to be finalized until later this summer, and looking at some of the timelines in the draft legislation, it's just, it's going to be really early to really have very much meaningful discussion before we see what the final rule looks like. And even after we get the final rule, I think that there's going to be a process where the state agencies are really going to have to do a lot of that technical analysis and come out with some of the information that would answer the questions that you all had today before we can even start talking about what kind of policies would we maybe need to comply and to put together our state implementation plan. So that's the one caution I have, is it's a little bit early, and your state agencies are doing a really good job at including people right now. So I wanted you to know that, that from the perspective of a pretty diverse group of stakeholders, I've seen many of our members around the table and felt very included. So that's all I need to say.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Mike Fries. I represent AOI, we're the state's largest business association, representing about 1,500 businesses that employ approximately 200,000 employees. I think, like the other panelists, have some concerns with kind of the time frames that are put in place in the draft legislation, and you know, this is, as explained by DEQ, this is a very complex issue. We expect the final rule, probably June, July, to also be complex, and any solutions that we, I think, work on together are also going to be complex and take some time. And so between a July and a September time frame is pretty short. And I don't anticipate, while I think our DEQ can do a great job and do wonderful things, that's asking a lot of a task force, and then also of our DEQ probably to give the task force enough information. Also, I think that the task force, as it kind of was outlined, I'm not sure that it's I appreciate the legislature's willingness and I guess interest in being involved, but it's almost it may even be under inclusive because there are so many people that will be impacted by this rule. And so, and especially as things change with what we expect to see in a or anticipate to see in a rule, final rule, as well as, well, how do we manage that, and is it a regional solution versus is it a state specific solution? And so I guess I would just caution the group in moving forward with this proposal, and if this committee does want to move forward, I'm sure that we could help at least craft a more reasonable time frame in order to make things happen, and then make sure that the business interests are adequately represented in a task force. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Polvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might just put something out there, I suppose, because during the interim we pre-session filed this particular bill, and I've been thinking about this and talking to the agencies about this since August, trying to figure out how the legislature weighs in on this process, how the legislature stays informed about it. Certainly we have great agencies that are doing a great job, but I was trying to figure out, how does the legislature weigh in on this or get a chance to be a stakeholder? Very difficult, you know, for us to be in that position. So we're just You know, we're part of government, but a different branch than our state agencies, and we represent consumers all around the state. And so, in as much as I sort of see the legislature as a stakeholder, it's very difficult for us to get a chance to weigh in on this process. And so that's why we the committee eventually introduced this bill, not so much as that we wanted to have our own stakeholder process or task force on this, perhaps. And the chair may or may not disagree or agree with me, but that we felt it very important that we at least stay informed, and certainly this particular proposal is keeping us informed because you're all here talking to us about it. As we go forward, I'm still sort of, Madam Chair, trying to figure out how does the legislature have an opportunity to weigh in on what our policies will be ahead of the game instead of coming back after the fact. Mm-hmm. So.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your participation, and I guess the more I think about this and what's being proposed regarding the oversight or legislative participation in this process, I think we heard pretty clearly from the agency today that they have embarked on a pretty thorough stakeholder-driven process in terms of responding to the original rule that came from EPA. It seems to me that they also continue to have the means in place to continue to consult with the utilities, with all of the various stakeholders that have an interest here, and I think that's what you were getting at. And I really question what the legislature can offer at this point in time other than simply perhaps bogging down the process or getting into a tug of war and so forth, some parochialism, if you might. I guess we've got an example just recently in front of us where the rules that came down regarding the low carbon fuel standard were handled by DEQ and so forth. I don't recall having a legislatively authorized task force to engage in that process, and they came up with what they came up with, and we'll have a chance to see whether we go up or down on that. But I'm impressed, I think, with the thoroughness, the diligence we've seen from the agency in really looking at the full spectrum on compliance and so forth, and how that affects our economy, what are the costs, short-term, long-term, and so forth. So I guess that put me in the camp of somebody who I think aligns with you all about this, perhaps the unnecessariness of having us involved in the process at this time, particularly when you don't really know when the final rule is going to come down anyway. So thank you for being here.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I'm just going to build on Vice Chair Johnson's remark. And Angus, you had said something about you're happy the legislature was involved. And I wanted you to elaborate on that because I think that's not quite what Vice Chair just said. So what is it that you think we as a group can add to this process that's so critical and so challenging?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Benz, thank you. So I think we can start by stipulating that the legislature is not just another stakeholder. It can be a super stakeholder, if you will.
It goes without saying.
But we are going to be getting, as we get into the development, the issuance of a final rule and the development of a compliance plan by the state agencies, there are these cost and cost distribution issues that are going to arise. There are going to be issues, at least we hope there are going to be issues with respect to Oregon working with other states to try to devise multi-state compliance strategies that either reduce costs or accelerate carbon reduction. And I hope we keep both of those goals in mind, because in answer to an earlier question, Representative Benz, that you asked, I think the answer is that Section 111D will fall substantially short of where the state's own adopted greenhouse gas reduction goals would take us otherwise. So it is a step, but it is not the complete step. And so the state's going to have to think, and which means the legislature is going to have to think about the resolution, the reconciliation between where federal actions like 111D, like the federal auto fuel economy CAFE standards, will get us and where we need to get to reach our state goals, in much the same way that when the legislature adopted the metropolitan area scenario planning for carbon reduction, we went through a process to establish what part of that reduction was going to come from federal actions, from state actions, and what part was residual to those local MPOs. You know, those are the kinds of judgments that the state has to make that are, I think, policy judgments above and beyond what the state staffs will be developing, being by way of sort of a minimum compliance plan that it can submit to EPA. But even that minimum compliance plan is going to raise a number of those costs and cost distribution issues in particular. And you know, those are issues that I think the legislature needs to weigh in and be a part of, because they're going to come home, you know, to the legislature eventually.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Whitener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to go on just with the legislature and where we're at, it seems like we have enough different departments that are looking out for the consumer but looking out for the environmental side, that we have plenty of information coming to us to weigh in. I know from the time that I've been on this committee and everything, and I think we do a pretty good job of relaying to you that we want low carbon, low cost energy is what we're after. Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, but don't you think the stakeholders have been very, very good at doing that and providing that? Obviously, we're 30% below everybody else in the nation. So it sounds like we have a pretty good system in place that we shouldn't mess with.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I think it is distinctly possible that between our energy efficiency, our RPS, and our Boardman decision, that, you know, we may be, depending on how EPA interprets the rule, we may be, you know, 80-90% of the way there. We might even end up with some excess headroom down the road. And if we did, then one of those policy questions we need to think about is, how do we leverage that headroom so that we can capture emissions reductions in the states that are delivering electricity from the coal plants in the Intermountain West to Oregon consumers. So, you know, that issue arises as well. But I think your essential premise is one that I would agree with, which is that the state staffs are doing a good job. They're doing an inclusive job. It's important for them to keep you briefed. It's important for the legislature to have them coming in and having stakeholders come in on a regular basis to say, where are we?
I guess the only thing, I mean, I'm happy to come back anytime and either in front of the committee or individually and talk to people about 111D. I was actually impressed. The questions that were asked today for a group of people who haven't been reading all 650 pages were very good questions.
Suffered.
And, you know, I'd be happy to come back and answer questions or discuss the Clean Power Act with any of the committee members at any time to answer questions. And, you know, I think staying informed and staying briefed is going to be key, as Angus says, so that when we do know if there are policy decisions that you will need to be making, that you are ready to make those decisions once they emerge. I just don't think we're quite at that point right now.
Chair Vega Peterson, I would agree. I think AOI is in the same position, and rest assured, when DEQ does something we don't like, you will hear from us. So, I would anticipate.
I see Palmer nodding in the background.
Yeah. So, yeah. I hope to that, you know, we continue this conversation, and it is a continuous conversation, because it's an important issue for Oregon.
Thank you all so much for your feedback, and I think that the spirit of it is, as Representative Holby says, we want to stay engaged because we know that this is a huge issue that affects all of our constituents, no matter where we are in the state. So thank you so much for that. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2191 and open a work session on House Bill 2451. We do have a -1 amendment for this bill, which is on OLIS. I think it's a little different from what I remember from OLIS last session. It's in the, there's a tab that says amendments where you can find the amendment. Beth, could you go ahead and remind the committee about the bill and talk a little bit about the Dash One Amendment?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2451 was heard in committee last Thursday. This is a bill that would authorize DEQ to use money in the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund to buy or refinance debt obligations of public agencies for all projects otherwise eligible for financial assistance through the fund. The Dash One Amendment would extend the loan term that may be authorized by the EQC from 20 to 30 years. And there is currently a subsequent referral to both Revenue and Ways and Means on the bill.
Okay. And colleagues, I spoke, we are going to actually remove the referral to the Revenue after discussion with LRO and the Speaker's Office. So that'll be part of the motion today as well. Okay.
Chair Vega Peterson, I move to adopt the Dash One Amendment dated 1/29/2015.
Rep. Johnson moves to adopt the Dash One Amendment dated 1/29/2015. Is there any discussion?
Where is it again?
I can't find it. You have to go to text.
Oh, good. I hear it. Introduced.
That's just the text. It doesn't have the amendment.
We've got two dash ones here.
So the two dash, yeah, they're, for some reason, Olish has two dash ones. Those are exactly the same dash one amendment. So pick whichever one you like.
Okay. I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention to Beth. Sorry. Can you explain the amendment?
Want me to do it again?
The Dash One Amendment?
The only thing the amendment would do is allow the EQC to extend the term of the loan from 20 years to 30.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I think that was part of the original.
They were talking about
that. Yeah. We talked about it as part of it.
The amendment wasn't ready when we had the initial public hearing on it.
Okay. I remember that now.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Is there any? Representative Benson.
I just want to make sure that we did identify on the record which one we're talking about. Is it? Can we do it by date?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, it is the both of them are dated 1/29/2015. For some reason, OLIS has just a duplicate of both of the.
Same one. Okay.
It's the same one, just posted twice.
Thank you.
One says dash one. One says one.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever juggle when you hit the button? As long as we know which one it is.
Yes, it's a one. Yes.
Are you not trusting the process?
Grumpy. How about the dash one?
Yeah, we will do the dash one amendment, dated 1/29/2015.
Many of the records show that this representative
Grumpy that's cleared out.
Okay. Any further discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Baker Peterson, I move House Bill 2451 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral of revenue be removed and that the bill be referred to Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Rep. Johnson moves that House Bill 2451 as amendment. It moves House Bill 2451 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to revenue be removed and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Tuna.
Representative Herrera. Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Fentz.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Reardon.
Aye.
Chair Vega Peterson.
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means, or to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. All right. With that, I am going to go ahead and close the work session and close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you. Do I have to close the work session?